Hang him from the yard.
Hello, boys and girls. What are we doing now? We are doing a second episode roundup of everything we've had from May and June of this past 2018 that we weren't able to get out in the main shows. And maybe a little opinion piece here or there that I've got on some of the movies that are coming out in theaters that I've had a chance to go see, but I can't give a full review of because there isn't a physical release or any special features, just a theatrical run sort of thing. So this episode, what have we got? I have Fox and Forest, which is an indie title that aims to bring back the 16-bit era mixed with a little bit of magic of today. And we've got Moonlighter, which is a, what if you mixed somebody who ran a shop in an RPG, like a storefront, and the Zelda dungeon crawly aspect. So with beautiful hand-drawn pixel art graphics. I have Onrush from Codemasters. We've got Vampyr from Don't Nod and Focus Home Interactive. And we've got a review of the actual voice recorder that I'm using here. We've been using these now to test. That's coming up after that. And we've got two, to finish off the show, we've got two different releases from Alpha Home Video. We have Last House on the Left Blu-ray and the Basket Case Blu-ray that are remastered. And there's very interesting opinions on that. So that'll close out the show, and let's get right into it. Here's Fox and Forest. Fox and Forest is a 2D 16-bit style action platformer with adventure and puzzle elements. Think a Ghosts and Goblins meets a Mario meets Zelda style game where you go left to right on the screen, up and down, collecting items, moving forward in each level, but you also have the ability to change the season, which will allow you to cross certain areas by freezing things or letting things grow on the screen. So, for instance, if you change the season to winter, a body of water will become ice and you can pass through it or on top of it, sorry. If you switch it to summer from spring or fall, it'll allow plants to grow that you can now jump on platforms. It's very unique, very interesting. It has a very much, I'd say, like a feel like it came out in, even though it came out in 2018, it's something you would have figured would have come out in around 1996 or 97. In that it's that beautiful 16-bit era, maybe, you know, when they fledgling turned into 32-bit, think early PlayStation 2D graphics. But with a visual flair that's very uniquely today in the pixel art as far as swapping seasons on the fly and how fast it runs and moves. The game is pretty fun. Collision detection is good. I didn't encounter any issues with it. It is something that you'll want to play over and over again just to play around with the different seasons as you go. And it's something that I would say checking it out is definitely worth it on the Nintendo Switch, which is where I got a copy for, in that it's something that plays, I think, best in small bursts on the go. It's not something that you necessarily need to have on the big screen, but with the Switch, it's definitely the ability to do that is right there, and it's awesome that you can just, you know, dock it, start playing it there, or pick it up and take it with you to work on the bus or in school, wherever, whatever you're doing, playing it in bed. So I would say check it out right now. Moonlighter is an action RPG indie title released by 11-bit Studios, developed by a Spanish studio called Digital Sun. Now, this is a beautiful pixel art game a la Zelda, where you own a shop by day, but then travel dungeons by night to uncover treasure and mystery. And it's something that's just very visually appealing and beautiful. Very fluid motion. The music, it matches perfectly for this sort of Zelda-esque title. I had the ability to play it on home console, and it's something that you have to sort of play to experience. It's flowing and beautiful and very deep in how it plays. I found it to be basically the sort of perfect Zelda clone that's been out recently. There's been a lot coming out lately, but I found it to be probably the most fun. Just going into dungeons, attacking enemies, collecting items and just experiencing it on the big screen. It's funny that it's a pixel art game, but it blows up on my big screen so well and so beautiful. This is part of that trend coming out now where we have, you know, for a while we had 8-bit titles that were done in high def where it just was like, you know, little dot pixel art. This is more like the evolution of what you would have figured had you not seen all the 3D titles on the PlayStation 1 and 64. It's what you would have figured the evolution of the pixel art on the Super Nintendo would have been moving into the 32 and 64-bit eras. So I would say definitely check it out. It's worth every penny for this title. Pick it up right now on PS4, Microsoft Windows, Xbox, Xbox One, and pretty soon the Nintendo Switch. That was Fox and Forest and Moonlighter, two indie titles that you're definitely going to want to check out. Now we're moving on into the racing genre, and I have a very interesting take on what I thought of Onrush, and you're going to have to listen to find out. So we've got that coming up right now. And right after that, you've got my review, a little more extended on Vampyr, because I had a lot of thoughts on it, because I do like the developer, and I thought the setting was really cool, and I wanted to delve a little deeper into that. All right, without further ado, we've got Onrush. We had that thing that everybody wants. Onrush is the new racing game developed by Codemasters and published by Deep Silver on the PS4, Xbox One, and Windows. Now, I received a copy for the Xbox One to review, and it's very different from most other racers out there in that you don't race to a finish line to win. And the different modes are all based on boosting or attacking other players. So there's one mode called Overdrive. Teams score points by boosting. The first team to boost enough to reach the target score wins. Countdown involves the series of checkpoints and a timer that drains over time. Teams can keep the timer running by successfully passing the checkpoints. If one of the team's timers runs out, the other team scores a point. Lockdown is a King of the Hill style mode in which teams fight to stay inside the zone, moving along the track with them for points. Lockdown is a King of the Hill style mode in which teams fight to stay inside a zone that moves along the track with them for points. Switch gives them Switch gives each member of the team three lives and tasks the team with taking each other down to win, but upon crashing, a player will respawn in a more powerful vehicle if they have lives left. So it's very different. It's very arcadey, which we're used to seeing a lot of simulator style games out there, like your Forzas or your Gran Turismo or Project Cars, that sort of style. And this harkens back to the days of the PS1, PS2, Xbox era of arcade style racers, and that this feels like something you would have played in an actual arcade, you know, linked up with multiple players. The graphics are pretty good for the style in that it's nothing that's going to overload your system. I never encountered like a frame rate drop or anything. It seemed buttery smooth the whole way through. Now, I'm playing it on an Xbox One S, so I don't have the capabilities of playing it on an Xbox One X to see if it did any, you know, faster FPS or enhanced graphics, but it seemed to play perfectly fine on my 4K TV that way. It's very vibrant in colors. The music is sort of secondary. The sound design is great as far as the effects from when you're blowing things up or when you're drifting or when you're boosting, and it had a really good feel. The closest thing I could say that this compares to recently that's come out is the old Burnout series. Not the Burnout series like we have now with like Burnout Paradise, but the old school ones where crashing feels fun. like you don't feel bad that, oh crap, I crashed, and then it feels sluggish or slow or anything. No, it feels fun that you're when you crash or when you bump off somebody and knock them off into the road and then they explode or hit somebody else. Now you race as three different types of vehicles. There's motorcycles, there's all-terrain vehicles sort of like trucks, and then there's your basic race cars, and they have sort of a rock paper scissors mechanic as to what they can do. Some are faster than others, some can do tricks, and some are heavier and beefier as far as knocking into other players. So that feels really, really unique and interesting. I keep saying that simply because it is different than what else is out there right now. The only criticism I can have, and honestly, in my mind, it's actually pretty big. It was a big deterrent when I was playing it, is it is online multiplayer only. There's no couch co-op for this game, and I even went on the forums to look it up at the Codemasters forums, and they apologized saying they wanted to include couch co-op as far as split-screen display or even on the same screen, but their budgetary constraints wouldn't allow it. Now, that seemed like a bit of a cop-out because this is being marketed as a full-priced game. You know, you're paying your $80 Canadian or your $60 American for it, and it's something that you would want to play with friends in the room. I wanted to play it actually with my roommate, and we were very disappointed when we couldn't play it together. So that takes away a significant chunk for me as far as how I would score it. Now, we don't give, you know, an A, B, C, D, or a number-based score, but that is a big, big, big detractor for me, and that this would have been made all the better if you had split-screen co-op. Now, playing it as a single player or playing it online, it is fun, so I'll give it that. But ultimately, if you want to play it, you're going to have to play it alone or with friends online that also have copies of the game. So in conclusion, I can say pick it up when it's on sale. This is not something you're going to want to pay full price for, because it is missing something very crucial that an arcade racer should have, which is the local multiplayer. So until it drops, you know, from full retail, I'd say hold off, unless you're an absolute diehard player, because it is fun. So I'd say right now, check it out if you're a hardcore player, or wait till it's a little cheaper. Vampyr, or Vampyr, however you want to pronounce it, Vampyr with a Y, is a new action role-playing game brought to you by Focus Home Interactive, developed by Don't Nod. Now, Don't Nod, you may have heard, is the developer, the French developer, that made the Life is Strange series. So this is their first foray into actual role-playing games, and I had quite a ball playing it. I had some issues, I'll get into that a little later, but let's talk about the good. I like the atmosphere that this game created, in that I went into it thinking that, honestly, that it was in the Victorian era London, but it's actually around World War I. You play a doctor that has recently awoken from what he thought was death and has become a vampire, and he's cursed, and it's his journey to try to stop a plague that's spreading, turning other people into sort of vampires, but not quite vampires, more like a zombie. Like a sickness that makes people vampiric in nature, but not full vampires like he is now. You're based out of a hospital, the Pembroke Hospital, and you're going around interacting with all the different players in the town. And each day, they can get sick, and you have to find ways to fix their ailments. Otherwise, the sickness level goes up in your different areas of town, and as people get sicker and die, you start to lose the health of the city, and if the health of the city goes down, you will lose the ability to do extra side missions for them to raise your experience and gain levels. Now, it's a very time-consuming dynamic to the game if you choose to actually go down that route and make and actually do all the side quests, because you have the ability at any time to take each of those NPCs, feed on them, and gain experience. You get more experience if you do more of their missions and talk to them and learn more about them and make them healthy. But you can also get more experience just from actually doing their missions. So you trade that off. Do you want to be a good person and feed as little as possible and get a different ending than if you lose a lot of people either to neglect or eating them? I went down the route of just trying to gain everybody's trust and then eat them as fast as I could whenever I needed to level up for a specific boss battle or level. I did find that there were some parts of the game that were a little unbalanced, especially at the beginning. If you wander too far, and it's easy to wander too far, you'll find people that are significantly higher level than you, and you'll die pretty quickly. There is no easy mode to the game. The game is the easier the more people you eat, because you gain more experience faster. Now, I don't remember anybody really scaling with my level, except for the final boss, which I'll get into in a bit. The music in the game was pretty good. There was nothing really to write home about, which Don't Nod in Life is Strange had very cool indie music, and this has sort of your atmospheric, what you would sort of figure from a vampire movie set in the early, you know, not even 1920, at 1918 or so. So it's pretty good. The visuals are good. If this was like the PS3 generation, I would say these are some of the best graphics you would have ever seen on the platform. But they're middle of the road. They're still good, but the textures and the faces and everything aren't really up to par with the AAA titles that are out now. That being said, this is a very small studio of 100 and some odd people in France, and it's not expected that they're going to be at the same level of, let's say, like a Santa Monica Studios game. And it is something that you'll have to go into thinking, if you think, hey, the graphics aren't great, the graphics are great. They're basically top tier if you're looking at the indie. So it's like, it's AAA indie, if that makes any sense to anybody out there. Now, the gameplay, here's where some parts of it falter. Some of the level design, you're basically going across certain sections of London. And being that this is the first RPG that this company has produced, I have issues with some of their design choices. One of them being no fast travel. So many times you're supposed to go from one end, especially near the middle to end part of the game, you're supposed to go from one end of London to the other, and it can take you several minutes to get around because you're going to have to beat up mobs that are around you, that are coming at you to attack, or you have to run around them. And it just seemed like it was a chore to run from point A to point B a lot, when in reality, you're discovering these safe houses all around town where you can go and sleep and level up. But keep in mind that every time you go to sleep, the condition of the town changes and you can start losing people. So you want to make sure that you only level up and sleep when you absolutely need to. But you figure you'd be able to transport fast travel to those individual places once they're discovered. But nope, they're on the map. You can set a waypoint pointer to find it, but then you can get lost going in all the twists and turns like I did many, many times. The other issue I had with is the navigation. There's no mini-map. So you have a thing on the top of the screen that sort of gives you an idea of which direction you should run to your next point that you've made, waypoint on the map. But to look at the map, you have to basically pause the game, pull up the map, look at where you are. Am I in the right direction? Okay, press a button to close the map, go back to the screen. But when you do that, there's about a 5-second delay before you can move. You'll just be running in your spot. So there's some issues with the game engine that they could have tweaked and made a little better. It's something you would have much more expected in the 5 to 10 years ago thing. Like, we're talking, you know, a couple years into the PS3 360 life cycle. These sorts of things happened a lot. I can forgive it simply because this is the first time they've made a game that wasn't a point-and-click adventure. I think they had made that Remember Me action game for Capcom in the past, but that was very early on and I didn't play that. But this is a company whose bread and butter is story and point-and-click adventures. So this is something new to them. I'm okay with it because it didn't destroy the game for me, but it was an annoying piece that stuck out in my mind as I was playing. The other part is the boss battles are hard at the beginning of the game, get very, very easy as you level up in the middle of the game, and then you hit the boss of the game, and I won't say what it is or who it is, but when you fight that boss, you think you've got it down pat till that point. And then I was at level 45 or so, and it turns out level 50 is the cap. I was at level 45, went to fight the boss, and the boss was level 54. And that was, to give you an idea, everything leading up to that point was level 32 in the end part of the game. So I was able to sort of breeze through everything until I hit that boss, and then it just completely smoked me. I had to go back and level myself up, and I leveled up to the max, even went beyond the max and leveled up extra powers, even though it wasn't going to get me anything more as far as other stats. And this is one thing, they don't actually show you what your stats are. Now, you can level up your hit points by increasing certain things, but you don't actually get to see what your strength stats are and other things like that, because I've leveled up, if I level up 10 levels and only level up one thing into my health, I've noticed that I do more damage to things, but it doesn't tell me that I do more damage. I just know it instinctively because now I hit a guy and he basically will fly across the room, and it doesn't make any sense because something's hinky with the numbers. So leveling up to level 50, I went to face the boss of the game again, and the boss of the game was now level 51. I don't know how that worked, but the boss's level went down as my level went up. So all I can think of is that this was done deliberately so that I could have to raise my level to the maximum to fight it. And I guess it discouraged you from trying to fight the boss at a lower level. Like, it wanted you to do everything that you possibly could in the game. And there was a satisfying epilogue and ending to it, and it could lead into something more, if not with the same characters. The world has been opened up. I don't know a lot about vampire lore. I'm not sure if it goes into it, but there seemed to be a lot of political intrigue with different factions of the vampiric London society. So I'm assuming that this might go into something like Vampire the Masquerade. I'm not sure. They obviously don't have the Masquerade license for that, because they had the title Vampire, but everybody's called vampires in the game. There's no reference to it being, you know, vampire with a YR at all in the game. So I have a feeling it had something to do with licensing for the title. Now, there's obviously a lot of research that was done into this, because the studio apparently went and actually went to London and looked up, you know, records of the town, what it looked like at the time, and tried to make the game as immersive as possible. And they did a pretty good job that way. Some of the dialogue is a little off. Some of the way the plot flows was a little off. Certain things are... relationships are formed, sort of just thrown together. There didn't seem to be a logical progression as to how it got to where it got. You're supposed to sort of fill in the gaps yourself. Now, I'm thinking that might be because this is a French team making a game in English, and that was a similar thing that happened with Life is Strange. In Life is Strange, it was very clearly a French vision of what they think living in Oregon as a 14 or 15-year-old girl would be. Like, it's the slice of American life from the view of a foreigner. Whereas if it was made in Canada, even though we're not the States, we're basically 90 or 95% the same as far as culture and geographically speaking. We probably, when BioWare makes a game about the States, it makes more sense because we are immersed in the culture 24/7. We speak the same language. We're basically almost the same country, depending on who you ask. This is very clearly like if we made a game about France, basing it on what we see on TV or in the movies, you know, we wouldn't necessarily get all the little details correct. So some of the little details are off. Some of the dialogue is a little stilted, but it's still very enjoyable. I think the reason it came across to me as a little odd is because the game is so high quality that you see the little tiny things, the little tiny little things that bug you. Now, I'm not trying to be down on the game. I very much enjoyed it. I do think a lot of these things could have been fixed with a patch update, you know, to put in waypoint travel and maybe a mini-map on the screen. And there were some visual glitches here and there. I did have the game crash on me once. I don't know what happened. It just crashed. Never happened again. So I don't know if it was a problem with my system, you know, or if it was a problem with the game itself. I would say it's definitely worth playing. If you're a big hardcore RPG fan, pick it up right now. If not, wait till it hits about that $40, $50 price point. Wait till it hits about half price, and then it's definitely worth checking out.
What about the wiener?
Now we're going to do something a little bit different in that we're reviewing hardware. So, I guess if it's coming out and you're hearing this now, that means that the reviews turned out okay as far as the voice recorder is concerned. But listen to this recording I did of the actual voice recorder. This is so meta, it's getting deeper and deeper. I'm doing a recording right now on a voice recorder talking about a review that you're going to listen to about the voice recorder recorded on the voice recorder in question. Yikes. Okay. So check that out. And then after that, we are going to have Last House on the Left and Basket Case that Mike the Birdman Dodd reviewed. We did watch it together, but he wanted to record his thoughts on it because he felt more strongly than I did on it. And you'll want to check that out. And then I'll bring you back for some closing thoughts on what's out theatrically right now and what I want to see, what I've seen, and my thoughts on those in general. This review is going to be a little different in that we're not reviewing any movies or games this time. There are a set of voice recorders sent to us from Evistar. Now, you might not have heard of that name before. They're not your Zoom mics or your other brands like Tascam or something, where there's the super high-end digital voice recorders that are on the market in the multiple hundreds of dollars range. This is probably the top tier of what you're going to find on Amazon at the consumer level, you know, the sub $100 level. Now, you'll see a ton of other brands out there that advertise cheap voice recorders in the $30, $40, $50 price point. These are in the $50 to $80 price point, but they have a significantly better build. We were sent two different ones to get, sort of samples of the line of products that they have out. We received the L57 and the L53. Now, the L57 is, I've been testing that a bit. It's a size of, a USB stick, maybe a little longer than that. And it is sort of ideal for when you go to, say, a conference or a meeting and you just want to record something simple. You press a button, leave it on in your pocket even, and it'll pick up a lot of things from the room. They're both very clear. I'm only going to spend a little time on the L57 because that is more of the just simple touch and go consumer level one, in that it has a mic built in, it has a headphone jack, it has the ability to play back MP3s, like, I guess that's a feature, but it records, interestingly enough, in wave format, so you can record as an MP3, or you can record in lossless wave, a stereo 16-bit, you know, your standard wave format, which is a little better than what you get from a generic cheap level one. You usually have to go into the Zoom mic level to receive that kind of quality, and it sounds pretty good. The mic that's input into it, it's actually fairly sensitive, so it will pick up a lot of things like breathing, or even, you know, if you move a little bit and you have it in your pocket, it's going to pick up a lot of movement sounds because that mic is very sensitive and it seems very tuned high. The actual menus on it are fairly simple to go through. It comes with a little booklet and a little charging cable, and interestingly enough, both of these recorders have metal bodies, so they have a little bit of weight to them. So that first little recorder, the L57, is something you'd want to get. It's about $40 or $50. It's something you want to get when you want something simple that you just need to record your meetings at work, or something that you can just take on the go. It's not something you'd really want to use for podcasting or for interviews, or outside in the field, because it has no other mic input on it. Now, jumping to the L53, which is actually what I'm using right now, and I've used it for the last few reviews that I've done, just to get a feel for it, has all the features of the L57. Interestingly, it's a lower number, it's L53, but the L53 is their full-featured recorder. It's about twice the thickness of the L57. It has all the same intuitive buttons on it, but this one actually has a mic input, so I'm able to plug in a standard stereo headphone jack microphone and record on that, which is what I'm recording on right now. I've done some tests with the built-in microphone, and it's similar to the L57s in that it's a little bit more sensitive than I would like and picks up a little bit more wind and more issues that way, but this does have the ability to plug in an extra mic. I've tried a lapel mic for one or two of the recordings. I've done right now I'm using just a handheld. This is just a simple $25, $30 microphone that I plugged in. It's not a condenser mic. It's just a normal dynamic microphone. And it sounds pretty good. You're able to have a visual on the screen view meter, so you can see exactly if you're peaking or not. It gives you indications on it. It flashes red when it's recording. It will give you an indication if you're peaking or go above a certain volume. You can turn the volume up and down as you're recording it. It has auto voice record. All the features you'd see on a much more expensive recorder, and has 8 gigabytes of storage. So it actually has a fair amount built in. I don't see any limitations as far as recording file size. It'll just keep recording. I believe it can go up to 4 gigs probably per file, because I think when I looked at it internally, it's formatted as a internal memory of FAT32. So there's a theoretical file size limit of 4 gigs on there. But in all likelihood, you're not really recording more than 4 gigs at a single time. All you'd have to do is just press the button to continue on, and it does have sequential recording, so if the file gets too big, it'll just move on to the next and I guess auto record that, so you don't ever have to really press a button to stop it. Now, this one has a built-in microphone that like I said, was pretty sensitive. It also has a built-in speaker, so you can actually listen to what you're recording on there directly, or plug in a headphone jack. I've also used this one with a microphone splitter. So I've plugged two different microphones in and recorded, and it doesn't seem to lower the quality or it doesn't come in quieter or anything. It seems to be pretty good. This is going to be an ideal one that we'll take with us when we go to different conventions or shows to, or do extra interviews on the go. It's something that, you know, I'm right now visiting family and I'm able to record just on the go and have a little recorder that's in my pocket. Now I'll have to edit everything afterwards, but I found that this is a very useful tool to have with me. And if you can't afford like an H1 or an H4N, you know, you're in the $150 to $400 range of voice recorders, this will do the trick for you for about $80. Now, would I say this replaces something at the professional level? No, it will not, because it doesn't have XLR inputs. You can't use this as a hot shoe mic on your camera or anything like that. You can't use this as an audio interface for your computer and use, and have it plugged in directly. You can transfer things using the USB cord and charge with it, but you can't use it as an actual microphone for your computer. So there's a lot of features that you don't get with this that you get at that, you know, price point that's three or four times the cost. But for the actual $80, this is probably the best thing I've seen on the market, and I would highly recommend picking it up. Pick up the L57, the smaller one, if you just need something to record quick on the go. But if you have the extra $20-$30, make sure you pick up the L53, because I think it's going to become a staple of Twig recordings for quite some time now. So now you've heard the recorded review of the voice recorder that I'm using right now to talk about the recorded review. And anyway, what we've got next for you are a couple of reviews of movies that Mike Dodd and I watched together. Last House on the Left and Basket Case, brought to you by Alpha Video. Very interesting, and you'll have to take a listen to this.
We're looking at The Last House on the Left Blu-ray, coming to us from Arrow Video. I gotta say, this is probably one of those movies that has always eluded me to watch over the years because of its director, Wes Craven. I'm a huge fan of the Scream movies, Nightmare on Elm Street, and he even did the Swamp Thing movie, if I'm not mistaken. So Last House on the Left was, I think, his directorial debut, if I'm not mistaken, back in 1972. And Last House on the Left is that infamous movie you've always heard people having heart attacks and throwing up in, and that stupid catchphrase, just keep repeating, it's only a movie, it's only a movie. And for the longest time, I was thinking, there's no way this movie can be as bad as they're saying it is. It's 1972, come on. I've seen Cannibal Holocaust. I've seen Cannibal Ferox. What do you got? And oh boy, what did I get? And I don't mean to build this up as much as I am, but what I got was probably one of the most uncomfortable movies I've actually had the, and I do say this, pleasure of sitting through in quite some time. The story, such as it is, features two women who decide they want to go off to a rock concert off in New York City. They tell their parents, hey, we're going away, we'll catch you guys in just a couple of hours. And the parents are like, okay, fine, we'll see you later, we're gonna throw you a birthday party, whatever. And they run across a group of criminals, completely by accident, while they're looking for some weed. And what happens next is a couple of days where they are raped, tortured, and eventually both murdered. And the story somehow keeps going with this, and eventually this movie turns into a revenge flick with the parents finding out that their daughter's been killed and the killers just happen to be staying with them. And then it turns into Home Alone briefly, where the dad sets traps and the mom, there's a scene with the mom that I didn't quite expect to see in the movie, and that's all I'm really gonna say about that. However, that being said, this movie does have its place in film history, despite what it does and what it is. This movie is an exploitation film, pure and simple. It comes from a different era of filmmaking, where you could get away with making a movie like this. Could you get away with making this movie now? Likely not, simply because of the implied and very visual rape scenes in this. There are two that I can think of. There was another one that has been lost to the ages, although still photographs still exist of this scene. and it's downright disturbing at times. Like, I would say this movie carries with it a trigger warning. If you're ever been a victim of sexual assault, yeah, probably don't watch this. But as I said, this movie does have its place in film history, and Arrow Video has done a wonderful job of preserving this bit of film history, as this is a 3-disc set. One of them is a soundtrack CD, which we didn't get that. We actually have unfinished versions of this movie, so I can't talk to some of the extras, such as the postcards and the fold-out poster, but I can talk about the actual video itself, which is a 1080p presentation of the unrated version, the most complete version of this movie you can find, and even it's looking a little rough around the edges. But what do I expect? This movie was from 1972. There's not exactly a whole hell of a lot of HD 35mm kicking around, or however this movie was shot on. But what I can say is this movie does a wonderful job of giving you the history of how this movie was made. There is a metric crap ton of interviews with people like Wes Craven, the composer David Hess. They also talk with some of the stars from the movie, like Fred Lincoln, evidently, who was a porno actor for a number of years. It's really cool just to see how many different people they got to come out and talk about this. I also talked with Sean S. Cunningham of the Friday the 13th franchise. They also have different cuts of the movie available on the second disc, where you get the Krug and Company cut and the R-rated cuts of the film. You also get a couple of new featurettes that are not archival, such as the Craven Touch, which is a bunch of new interviews with people who've worked with Craven over the years. You talk with people like Ray Frumkes, and I'm pretty sure I said his name wrong, but he remembers Wes Craven making this movie. And you also have an unfinished short film by Wes Craven called Tales That'll Tear Your Heart Out, which is this weird Western type sort of thing. They also have a Q&A from one of the stars that was from a 2017 screening of this. Now, this is where it gets difficult. Do I recommend The Last House on the Left? If you're new to horror, you're going to have to do your research going into this movie. Basically, know exactly what happens in it and make up your own mind from there. Me and Alex said this is for film historians and horror buffs only. To everybody else, I'm going to say this movie's got its place. It comes from a different time of filmmaking, and Wes Craven made no apologies for it. Even some of the film stars have distanced themselves from it. There's one of the interviews where literally I think the guy that plays Krug said he couldn't go down the street in the 70s without people thinking he was literally going to rape and kill them. So it was a little intense. And one of the film stars, the guy who went on to do porno, eventually said his mother wouldn't forgive him for it. He thinks anybody who was associated with this movie is disgusting, and it's the thing he's the most ashamed that he's ever done. So, The Last House on the Left is a piece of history, and make up your own mind on it. And it comes to us from Arrow Video, exclusively on Blu-ray. Today we are taking a look at Basket Case, brought to you by Arrow Video. This is a movie that I have heard about, once again, for years, most notably from James Rolfe, the angry video game nerd of Cinemasker.com, covered this a number of years ago during his Halloween series, Monster Madness. The story of Basket Case follows two brothers, two Siamese twins who've been separated. There's Dwayne and the evil twin Belial, who looks like a wad of silly putty with two hands to it, who can kill you somehow, but he's always carried around a basket, so most of the times he's pretty harmless, because what's in the basket is the question that always comes up when Dwayne happens to be going about his business. And what happens is this movie, it's a revenge flick. Basically, they're going after the doctors that separated them and basically seeking their revenge. However, Dwayne eventually starts to realize, you know what, maybe this isn't what I want. I want maybe a normal life. And he does meet a young woman named Sharon, who is extremely beautiful, I might point out. Things go awry as Belial gets jealous. thinking his brother's going to leave him, and things get pretty screwed up from there. Eventually, the movie ends. Well, I'm not going to tell you how it ends because there are two sequels, which are unfortunately not in this collection, but I'm kind of hoping they get the same treatment, actually. So the thing that makes the Arrow Video version of this movie really stand out is there is some wonderful special features. There's actually archival documentaries on here, which one of them is actually feature length. One of the ones that stuck out to me is they actually made Basket Case 3.5, which is sort of follows up to the events of Basket Case 3, and it's pretty weird. The guy that played Dwayne gives it his all as best he can and follows the filmmakers, sort of like Blair Witch style, I guess. But they also have a new sequence called Belial's Dream, which is this short, sort of not quite animated, not quite claymation. It's really weird. That's all I can say. It's weird. But they also have lots of interviews with the cast and crew of the movie, the director. And I'm really happy with how this particular disc turned out. This movie's weird. It's frankly fucked up. But you should probably watch it. It's surprisingly entertaining. I think Roger Ebert gave this movie something like 3.5 stars. He really liked it. So I'm going to be inclined to agree with Roger Ebert. I rather enjoyed this movie. It's surprisingly entertaining. It's got a little bit of heart to it because there is some sweetness in there to these brothers, despite being in this tragic situation of being twins and being ripped apart. You genuinely see that the brothers care for each other. And while there is murder and mayhem to behold, there's a story in there too of, like I said, brotherly love, so to speak. You can find this movie on Amazon.com. It is totally worth your money, especially if you love horror movies, and especially if they're a little bit campy, coming out of the early 80s, late 70s era. And if you can track down the sequels, I think you'll see the story of Dwayne and Belial get a little bit more strange than you're probably used to. But hey, that's sort of the weird and wackiness that Arrow Video has been putting out recently. So check out Basket Case, available exclusively from Arrow Video. You should check this out. I loved it.
Me lucky tater tots.
It's that time. It's time for the end of the show. And what do I have for you right now? I wanted to talk a little bit about what's been in theaters recently. Right now, we've got the trend of lots of superhero movies, lots of big blockbuster popcorn movies, because it is the beginning of summer, even if it's felt like it's been summer for over a month with this heat wave we've been having. Now, what did I see recently? I've seen Deadpool, which I thought was pretty cool. I'm not going to go into that because that's a little farther removed now. I saw Avengers, same deal. Now, what have I seen in the most recent couple weeks that's out? I did recently just go and see Incredibles 2, and it was strange to me to realize how far removed it had been since the first film. We're talking the better part of 15 years, which is kind of amazing to me because everybody seemed to sort of jump right back into it. And I didn't really notice that there was like any visual difference from the original. It might be that I'm thinking of the original film through like rose-tinted glasses, in that I thought that it looked basically the same. Now, I know it's got to be higher visual quality. The big thing that came out of this for me was, you're going to like it regardless. Like, I'll tell you right now, if you like the first, you're going to like it. It's Pixar. They almost never have a dud. But the big thing for me was, this movie was 2 hours and a little bit longer. It was like nearly 2 hours and 10 minutes, including the credits. That might be the longest animated film I've ever seen in theaters. And it didn't feel like it. And I'm not even counting like the trailers at the beginning and all the commercials they threw in. It's a 2 hour movie. Usually Pixar films are at the hour and a half mark, which is what you sort of expect for a feature length action film or a family film. Disney traditionally was a little shorter than the hour and 20, hour and 25, but we're talking 2 hours and it went by like a breeze, like nothing, like there was no problems of pacing. It felt like it could have even gone on longer and people would have been watching it. When I saw it, there were no kids screaming. Kids were just watching it. It was weird. Like the theater was full and kids not once were talking. Like they were so mesmerized by what was happening on the screen. So, you know, kudos to them. So that I picture is going to be a pretty big movie this summer, even though, you know, it's so far removed from the original film as far as time goes. Like we're at a point now where kids that went to see it that were like 5 years old could now take their own 5 year old kids, if they had kids really young, to see it in theaters. That's weird. And it doesn't feel like it's actually been that long. It feels like it was just yesterday that movie came out. Other than that, I'm trying to think of what I've seen recently that I was impressed by, or maybe I think should be getting more praise than it has been getting. And there's not much, because everything's been so full of these blockbuster pictures that they're filling up so many screens. I saw Super Troopers, and that was funny, but meh. It's not going to make a big splash really anywhere. And other than that, there really hasn't been much out there that has been worth going to see in the first place. Coming up, there's the Jurassic World movie, but when I see that, I keep seeing people saying how terrible it is, and I kind of get the feeling, looking at the trailers, it didn't really want to appeal to me. I think that's going to be a Netflix movie for me. That's going to be something that we watch after it's already out. I don't plan on spending a lot of money to go to see it, that's for sure. I saw Solo in theaters, and I was meh. I was okay with it. It was a decent movie, but nothing to write home about, and that's sort of what the box office has said about it. Coming out later in the summer, I want to see Ant-Man. But it's like there's generally going to be about three or four pictures now for each month of the summer that are going to be in theaters for the better part of several weeks, where they're taking up so many screens that even though two of my local theaters have 12 screens, they're only playing four movies because they're all taking up every screen. So to get out of that, you kind of have to go to the art house theaters. We've got one called the Princess Cinema here, which was traditionally an art house theater that now has three screens over two locations. One of them you have to walk up like 40 steps in the side of an old bar. Like it's one of these things that was, I believe, a burlesque show originally that they turned into a screen like 30 years ago. And then they show the artsy fartsy stuff. And then we've got the Apollo Theater. The Apollo is a single screen downtown that has, like, they serve alcohol there. They've got some tables you can sit at. Like, when you sit at your chair in front of you in the first five rows, there's actually tables that you can share, so you can actually eat food there. And it's a really cool theater, but it's only one screen, so they're generally only showing two movies a day, and you can only see one showing per day. So they show stuff that's outside of what's been in theaters recently. So let's say Avengers leaves theaters. They'll then get it for, you know, 2 weeks, a two-week run of once a day they're showing it. They'll also get independent films, or they'll get ones that are foreign films. Like they'll do like a Miyazaki show where it's a whole bunch of Studio Ghibli stuff. So right now they're showing Isle of Dogs, which looks interesting to me. But I don't know. I'm just sort of become a little disenfranchised with summer movies. I see maybe like two or three that I want to see. It seems more of the movies I want to see are being released in like February now, where that used to be the dead month. So, you know, basically those are my thoughts on what's coming up this summer. I'm probably changing my mind as I see more trailers for things coming up. I want to see The Equalizer and a few other titles, and Skyscraper, that looks pretty cool. But I'm sort of, this is probably going to be more of a Alex watches DVDs and maybe some Netflix and play some games for reviews for the summer, because I'm just not seeing a reason to really go to theaters anymore, especially at the $12 they want to charge for a ticket. Like, I went there, $24 for a large popcorn, large drink, small snack combo. $24. For anybody listening in the States, that's like $18, $18 or $19 for, like, it's twice the price of the ticket to get food. And they wonder why people sneak food in, or, you know, don't buy their concessions, and they go, like, we have to raise the prices because we're not making enough. No, how about you charge like $5 for, you know, popcorn, or you charge like $12 for popcorn, drink, that, make it the same price as the ticket, or make a deal. $20 gets you your ticket, a large popcorn, large drink, and whatever. Like, people are willing to pay that, but not when they see $24 for just the popcorn and drink combo. And so what you're telling me is that it's going to be $35 after taxes to go to the movies and buy what they have there. It's ridiculous. That's why places like the Apollo, the independent ones, are doing better, because they have a membership deal where you pay like $10. It gives you a year of membership where you get reduced rates. especially like things like free birthday movie. But they'll do things where it's large popcorn, large drink for $8.50, and that's refillable. So if you see a double feature, you only have to pay $8.50, and you can fill up your popcorn or your drink again. So that's the sort of stuff that the big chains need to do. Now I'm going to finish my rant and really end the show because I'm just rambling. So I'll be back soon on Twig itself, as well as probably a commentary or two with Birdman. We'll see what we're going to be doing this weekend on Canada Day, 4th of July weekend. And as far as Twitter Treasure, it'll be back probably in a few weeks once we've gathered enough material and we've got something we want to talk about. I've got a few ideas brewing for what I want to do as far as times where we don't have necessarily extra reviews or stuff that we have to fill the show. I'm probably going to start doing sit-down watches of specific shows and then talking about reviews, things that are already out, things that might not be ones that we were sent for review, but ones I've wanted to watch or talk about or have heard buzz about for a while. And it'll be maybe something where we pick a show that was dead for, you know, it only ran 3 or 4 episodes and then was canceled. Well, maybe we'll watch those 3 or 4 episodes and try to analyze why it was canceled. That sort of thing. That's what basically makes me tick and what I find interesting is finding the rare and the obscure and seeing if they would work today or if they worked back then, but they just, you know, were shit canned for whatever reason or another. Okay, so until next time, I've been Alex the producer signing off.
Okay, son, now you're starting to scare the viewers.
Just act normal.
I'd ask you to do the same, but I'm afraid that ship has sailed.
Why are there so many ostriches?
But you have a game that is dipped in the f-
ropey, thick, window cocking.
So guys, we'll be right back right here on This Week in Geek, only on thisweekingeek.net and many other sites where I syndicate this crap, because I'm a media slut.
I like turtles.
Loose like your mom.
That's right.
No fisting, you say. Anything else you object to?
Me lucky tater tots.
You've been listening to This Week in Geek. Check out our website at thisweekingeek.net for more geek content and subscribe to our podcast through iTunes or any podcatcher. If you'd like to comment on this episode, head to this episode post on thisweekingeek.net and comment through Facebook Connect. Or you can call our voicemail line at 817-717-7202. Follow and message us on Twitter at thisweekingeek. And check out our Instagram at twig_official_podcast. And if you're the good old-fashioned email type, send us an email at feedback@thisweekingeek.net. We'll see you next time. And remember,
lower your shields and surrender your listenership.